Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Nancy Solomon from the WNYC Newsroom. I also host a podcast here called Dead End. And today I'm filling in for Brian Lehrer, who's off today. On today's show, we're going to talk about the implications of a case from Hudson County, New Jersey, where the suspect was identified using facial recognition software from the NYPD. An attorney from the ACLU of New Jersey will join us to explain why this case is concerning. Plus, a big storyline from the 2018 midterm elections was the suburban women activists who were instrumental in flipping the House to Democratic control. Two of those activists will join us to talk about what they're up to ahead of this year's midterm elections. And to wrap it up in today's show, we're going to tackle an age-old geographical debate. Where does upstate New York begin? We'll take your calls on that and what kind of fall stuff you might want to do when you go upstate this weekend or anytime this fall. But first, we'll continue our series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. Today, we've reached issue number 5, immigration, political asylum, and the border. Our guest, Caitlin Dickerson, who covers immigration for The Atlantic, spent 18 months investigating the Trump administration's family separation policy. So we'll get a few key takeaways from her on her reporting on that. We'll ask her what's changed since then and whether Biden and the Democrats are struggling to come up with an immigration plan. And of course, we'll look at the way immigration is playing out as an issue in the lead up to November's midterm elections. So joining me now is Caitlin Dickerson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hi, Caitlin. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me, Nancy.
So listeners, help us report this story. How high is immigration on your list of priorities ahead of the midterms? And how are you seeing immigration and border policy play out in the congressional races in your own backyard? The number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can tweet at us at Brian Lehrer. So Caitlin, you spent months exploring the details of Trump's family separation policy at the southern border. I want to get to that in a moment, but I wonder how much influence you believe Trump still has on Republicans and the Republican immigration policy and the reaction from Democrats nearly 2 years after he was voted out of office?
Well, I think there's no question that Trump's positions on immigration are still definitely influencing Republicans, you know, prominent Republicans. Of course, I'm thinking of Ron DeSantis in Florida. I'm thinking of Governor Ducey in Arizona, who seemed to completely take a page right out of former President Trump's book by starting this initiative to bus migrants from the southwest border to northern cities that run by progressive governments. You know, not a meaningful policy choice in any way, but something that was meant to stir up, you know, emotions, you know, get a base of voters who are really focused on trying to clamp down on the southwest border, enthusiastic, you know, to get their attention, to show, you know, that these other Republicans who are trying to make a bigger name for themselves are on their side. It's very reminiscent of, you know, the tack that Trump began taking when he was running for president in 2016 and then obviously carried into the White House. And I think that, you know, to the point of your question on whether it's influencing Democrats, I think it's fair to say it is, because I think that when you see the really enthusiastic and positive response to those efforts, even though it's small, you know, it's not by any means a majority of Americans, but I think that, you know, the enthusiasm around stunts like the ones that we're seeing now, I think help to put Democrats on the back foot in a way to make them feel sort of defensive. I think, you know, we can get into it, but we've seen a real sense of fear when it comes to the Biden administration and, you know, Democrats who maintain majorities in both chambers of Congress, you know, a reticence to push forward. And I think that's because of a fear of, you know, backlash and just uncertainty over just how many Americans actually want to, you know, change the immigration laws in the way that Biden suggested he did, you know, in his first few weeks in office. So we've seen very little movement there.
We will get into the sort of current landscape in a few minutes. I definitely want to return to what you just said, but let's take a step back first. I mean, you published this tremendous piece of reporting about Trump's separation policy, the separation of families at the border, and that which all began in secret. So tell it. Let's back up and tell us about that story and you know, remind us about what happened with separating families and what you found out about it.
Sure. So, you know, I had covered the separation of families at the time. I was a reporter at the New York Times, and, you know, just watching it unfold alongside the rest of the country, as you mentioned, it started in 2017 in secret. And so it started with me and other reporters, you know, finding examples of families that were being separated and then going to the administration, asking what was going on and being told, you know, nothing to see here. We're not actually separating families. Ultimately, you know, the Trump administration came out into the public and in the summer of 2018 announced that they were going to begin separating families, even though they'd already been doing it for a year at that point. And so it was a huge national story, but we didn't really understand the origins of it because it began so quietly, which was really outside the norm for, you know, an administration that had previously seemed to enjoy, you know, shouting from the rooftops about all the things that it was doing to crack down on the Southwest border. So I went back to the beginning, tried to figure out how it happened, why it happened, who was responsible. I found that the roots of family separation really stretch all the way back to 9/11, when this approach to border enforcement known as prevention by deterrence came out of a goal of the George W. Bush administration to just do anything it possibly could to crack down on terrorism, including things like prevention by deterrence, which have not had any meaningful impact on terrorism, nor have they had a meaningful impact on flows across the Southwest border. But it's sort of the best that law enforcement could come up with at the time. And in the absence of reform by Congress, here we are 20 years later, it's still the status quo. And that remains true today. And so this idea is to basically punish people for crossing the border without authorization. It starts being used against singles, mostly single men who are migrant laborers crossing the border that way. It's then expanded and applied effectively to asylum seekers. You know, and through the Obama administration, families were exempt, but that changed under Trump. So, you know, the idea came from a man named Tom Homan, who rose to be the head of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, but had been in enforcement for decades. And it was the combination of, you know, the enthusiasm for this prevention by deterrence approach that already existed within the rank and file, and then an administration that was, you know, willing to throw out all procedures, you know, all systems that existed to prevent bad policies from being made, that existed to prevent, you know, logistically nightmarish policies from being implemented. Those all went out the window. And so these two groups came together and decided that it would be a good idea to take people's children away from them to discourage migration, despite all the evidence that such an effort wouldn't work, didn't work, and also, of course, was devastating to the thousands of families that were impacted.
And then how do things change once it becomes not secret, but once Trump publicly acknowledged it?
Well, the numbers increase really dramatically. You know, so you have hundreds of separations happening per day at individual border patrol facilities. But even though there, you know, there were a year of separations prior to this publicly being announced, you still didn't have any processes or procedures for keeping track of where parents and children were ending up, for reunifying them ultimately. So it's really striking. You know, there's much has been made, and I think appropriately so, of the morality and of the decision to separate families, whether it was a good idea or not. But But setting that aside, you know, I also spent a lot of time focusing on just the complete lack of logistical planning, really almost none, prior to this policy being implemented publicly. And you even had, you know, after, you know, so you, listeners may remember that there were most of the parents who were separated from their children were prosecuted, and that was sort of the pretense. But even after those prosecutions were complete, you had officials within the Trump administration trying to prevent families from being brought back together.
Now, you reported on what the Trump administration, like what they understood about the potential outcomes from this practice. So tell us a little bit about some of the documents that you were able to unearth and what did they know about what this would do?
So when family separations becomes public, you know, and frankly, you know, Republicans and Democrats, Republicans who you never expected to hear from, people like Ted Cruz, come out against it because of the logistical chaos that I'm describing. Then you hear an argument start to come out of the White House and out of the Department of Homeland Security that, you know, these logistical challenges never could have been anticipated. And that was something that, you know, I wanted to fact check. And sure enough, I found that there were many people within the government who were raising red flags about all that would go wrong with a policy to separate families on a large scale. I mean, in granular detail, you had the Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Department within the Department of Homeland Security writing reports that said, you know, if this is pursued, you will have, quote, future populations of U.S. orphans. You know, you will have babies and infants separated from their parents. You will have, you know, you will lose track of parents and children. You'll have parents deported without their children. You'll have children deported without your parents. All of this was anticipated in advance. And I also got a hold of records associated with an early prosecution initiative in 2017, where some of those first separations took place in El Paso. It later became known as an El Paso pilot program because it was eventually sort of held up as a model. You know, hey, we did this in El Paso, so we should expand it nationwide. And again, you know, coming out of the El Paso program, I was told by officials leading DHS under President Trump that they had no idea anything had gone wrong. You know, in Washington, as far as officials were concerned, everything went smoothly, and that's just not true. I reviewed, got a hold of the reports that came out of that early prosecution initiative, which were shared with these high-level officials. And the reports sure enough say that, you know, magistrate judges were raising concerns about parents and children getting lost. The document actually, it concludes with one recommendation, which is, you know, to come up with a process for keeping track of parents and kids. And still, it never happened. And then this policy is implemented on a much wider scale. So it's, you know, the level of ignoring, you know, expertise, you know, and ignoring all of these recommendations to try to prevent harm was really, really striking. And it goes on for over a year and involves lots of people who just seem to have wanted to put this into place no matter what.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Nancy Solomon sitting in for Brian. Listeners, we want to hear from you about how you see immigration and where does it sit on the list of priorities ahead of the midterms and what you're hearing in your own districts from those running for election in November. The number to call is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can tweet us at Brian Lehrer. We're talking with Caitlin Dickinson about immigration and the midterms. So, and we've been talking about the separation of families at the border, the Trump policy. So what have you been able to find out about what has happened now, years later, with the families that were separated?
So between 700 and 1,000 families remain separated today, according to official government records, which is a really high number. It's important to point out that lawyers and those working in the Biden administration on reunifications believe that some of those families may have found each other independently and not reported it to the U.S. government, kind of understandably, from a position of wanting to avoid any further interaction. But that still leaves many families separated years after, you know, this policy was put into place. And you have, you know, over 150 children whose parents to this day still have not even been located by the U.S. government. We don't know where they are. We took their children away as a country and just haven't been able to find them ever since. And that's, of course, not to speak of the thousands of children and parents who were reunited, but are very much still dealing with the consequences of what they experience today. You know, very, very severe PTSD symptoms are being reported by the healthcare practitioners who are treating separated parents and children. There is a federal case that requires those families that have that are in the United States, at least, to be offered mental health care. And, you know, what I heard from therapists who've treated many of these families who I interviewed for my story is that, you know, this is really just the beginning. You know, right now what they're working on is trying to reconnect parents and kids and rebuild a relationship that was really deeply harmed. But that, you know, the trauma that results from separation is something that continues to come out over the course of a person's life, that that doesn't resolve in 6 months or a year, that really it can be lifelong. And, you know, that was also something that was warned about in some of those records we were talking about earlier that I obtained through FOIA requests and then eventually lawsuits against the government. All of this was anticipated. And so, you know, these families, whether they're reunited or not, are very much still dealing with the ramifications of what happened.
So let's now come back to current times. Do you see a direct thread from family separation to now what we're seeing with Texas Governor Greg Abbott or Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and the others? Attempt that they're doing of busing asylum seekers to New York City or Martha's Vineyard and elsewhere. How are these two things connected?
You know, one of the themes that emerged prominently in my reporting on family separation was just the distance that existed in a lot of decision makers' minds between, you know, the humanity of the individuals being impacted by family separation and, you know, the choices that they were making. You know, people become numbers, they become data points. And I think that, you know, I don't want to oversimplify it, because when you are in DC and you're making policies that impact thousands of people, sure, it can be hard to kind of grapple with that on a granular level on a day-to-day basis. But when you're talking about separating kids from their parents, I mean, you know, I really can't overstate how significant that is. And don't take it from me. You can call up any mental health professional and ask that question. And for that matter, really any prosecutor in the country who's worked on cases involving parents and kids will tell you that, you know, pursuing an initiative that's going to, you know, to do this to thousands of families is a really big deal that's going to have really big consequences kind of for everybody involved. But the people who made the decisions to implement the family separation ultimately seem to just forget that, you know, to the point where we would be talking about in a kind of bland way, you know, their decision making and, you know, why or how they supported separating families. And in the middle of our interview, they would, you know, say, oh, hold on, Caitlin, I need to go and, you know, talk to my child. I need to go and drop my kid off at school. You know, let me give them some crayons and paper so that, you know, they're distracted so you and I can have a conversation. They didn't see the connection between the humanity of their own children and then the children that they chose to separate from their parents. And I suppose, you know, you can see something like that in the way that, you know, migrants who have been bused, at the very least, those who were seem to have been misled, you know, told that they were going to be given jobs, but and told that they were going to be given, you know, safe haven and housing, but actually just bused to a random location, you know, Martha's Vineyard, for example, and sort of tricked into that for the sake of, you know, a political stunt, for the sake of, you know, news coverage. And I suppose, you know, a boost to, you know, these Republican candidates, these Republican governors and decision makers, you know, to their reputations. I mean, I think that there's a failure to acknowledge humanity there. And so I think that's a potential link you can draw.
You know, the country, of course, we talk about this all the time, the country is so divided. I'm wondering, I mean, has there been any blowback against Abbott or DeSantis from the Republican Party, from their voters, about the way that people, like, that these people were not treated as human beings?
I think there has been some, and it sort of remains to be seen. I think that, you know, subsequent elections will tell us something about that as well. But, you know, what I have noted in the last several years covering immigration is that, you know, historically there was a pretty significant part of the Republican Party who was very pro-immigration from a sort of business perspective, for example. And that segment of Republicans has been really increasingly quiet, right? We don't hear pro-immigration Republicans dominating, you know, national discourse or even at the state level discourse. That sort of compassionate conservatism that is often used to describe people like George W. Bush, you know, really seems to have gone away and given way to an approach to immigration that looks more like that of former President Trump. So, you know, I do think that those conservatives are out there. And I have seen, at the very least on the local level, some people who've come out and criticized, you know, Ron DeSantis's stunt, for example, you know, people who support border security, who support, you know, an immigration law that is, that, you know, modernized to address the current circumstances, and that is enforced, you know, one that actually has some weight behind it, but that is thoughtfully rewritten, you know, which only Congress can do, you know, but who feel that, you know, using people and, you know, sending them to a far-flung location just for a headline is, you know, counterproductive. I have seen that a little bit, but as I said, you know, the most of what you hear from kind of the more prominent Republican politicians today, it looks more like what President Trump had to say about immigration when he was in office.
Well, there's plenty of criticism to go around, and I think we can direct some of that at Democrats when we come back. But first, we're going to take a short break. And after we come back, we'll also take your calls. So stay with us. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Nancy Solomon from the WNYC newsroom, filling in for Brian Lehrer, who is off today. I'm speaking with Caitlin Dickerson, staff writer at The Atlantic, and we're talking about immigration, political asylum, and the border for our series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. So, Caitlin, a new NPR Marist poll found that immigration was the most important issue for Republican voters behind inflation. It was nowhere near the top for Democrats. Is it a fair criticism from Republicans that Democrats haven't done enough to fix the immigration system?
Absolutely. You know, neither the Democrats or Republicans have meaningfully changed our immigration laws in decades. And there have been plenty of opportunities. You know, the current situation with Democrats controlling both chambers of Congress is one example, but it's not the only example. And I think that part of the reason why we haven't seen, you know, a change from Democrats is that polling that you mentioned. But certainly, it's, you know, both sides carry blame here.
Let's go to the calls. We have Patrick in Fanwood, New Jersey. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that one of my frustrations is with the Democratic Party, because I don't think the Democrats are very good at articulating why the country would benefit from immigration reform. You know, basically the Republicans, you know, control the conversation. For instance, this morning I was listening to another story in NPR about how the U.S. Auto industry is trying to transition from combustion engine to electric vehicles, and how they don't have, you know, the expertise and engineers to do that. And, you know, one solution would be to liberalize the immigration laws to allow more people to stay, you know, that can contribute to that change. Another issue would be, you know, an article that I read last year about how during COVID population, you know, there have been less births in the United States, and how going forward that's going to be detrimental as the population gets older. Well, one solution would be to help, you know, increase immigration so that there are people to actually care for an aging population. So it's frustrating because I think the Democrats could do a much better job at articulating why, how the country would benefit by change, and but they don't do that.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. So, Caitlin, in your reporting, do you ever get a sense of why it is that Democrats don't articulate this, you know, these kinds of a vision of how immigration is good for the country?
I do, and thank you for your call. I've been doing some reporting recently on, you know, what happened to the push for legislation around family separation, but also immigration reform generally. President Biden came into office with a pretty explicit plan for reforming the immigration laws that didn't go anywhere. And I think, Patrick, you were right that, you know, Republicans have, and, you know, the Donald Trump Republicans have a clear message on immigration, which is, you know, we are being invaded as a country. And, you know, despite all of the inaccuracies and complexities and nuances and you know, problems with that argument, it's clear. And you don't have a clear argument on the other side. It's tends to be a very defensive posture, but not one that seems to lead, that seems to, you know, tell Americans what, you know, the current White House, for example, what their view of, you know, where our immigration system should go is. And so I do think that that is a key problem or a key part of what has held Democrats back from actually substantively changing our immigration system in moments like this one, where an opportunity may have existed. You know, I think that part of the issue with immigration, frankly, you know, and with the country in trying to move forward here, is that we're all sort of talking about different things when we talk about immigration reforms. Some people want immigration reform because they want, you know, more robust humanitarian policies. Some people want immigration reform because they want to feel safer and they worry about, you know, how their safety might be impacted by immigration. Some people want immigration reform because they want to, you know, help businesses boom, or some people want, you know, tighter restrictions because they think it might harm business. And so I think what we're missing is evidence a lot of times in the national discourse over immigration, but also clarity about what it is that we're talking about. Are we talking about economic policy or humanitarian policy or criminal justice? So you have the country really talking past each other. And but through it, you have, again, you know, the Republican Party currently persisting with this clear message, and then a lack of, I think, that type of clarity on the side of Democrats. And so we're sort of stuck.
Thanks for your call, Patrick. Now, Caitlin, I mean, isn't there a part of what DeSantis and Abbott are doing that actually makes sense, even if the way that they've gone about it is seriously messed up? But wouldn't it be better for immigrants coming across the border to be helped with settlement and be spread across the country so that, you know, cities and towns all across the country take on new immigrants coming across the border, and it isn't as much of a huge impact on the southern states along the border?
That actually happens regardless of whether migrants are handed a bus ticket by, you know, the government of Florida or the government of Texas. You know, people who've crossed into the United States recently don't tend to stay in the Southwest border for a very long time. I think, you know, there's a lot of misinformation around this. But look to, you know, have you seen a news story that says, you know, the South Florida or South Texas public school system is buckling under the weight of new migrants, or that, you know, the hospitals are unable to provide health care to South Texas residents. You don't see those headlines because it's actually not as if these communities are crumbling. I mean, people, when they come to the United States, as I said, they don't tend to stay in one place for very long. They tend to go and join, whether they have family or whether they have friends or just other people from the community they left behind, and join, you know, an immigrant community in the United States where they're going to be surrounded by people that they can communicate with, have some cultural association with, and can work. So people are doing that, moving around anyway, you know, and it really, I think, you know, the only thing that changed here was, you know, where they got their bus ticket, with the exception of those who were actively misled, you know, those who were sent to Martha's Vineyard, for example, and offered something that was never actually on the table.
So let's talk about the midterm elections. Should Republicans win back control of the House in November, what types of immigration, political asylum, or border policies might we see in the near future?
So throughout the remainder of the Biden administration, if Republicans take back one or both chambers of Congress, I think we're unlikely to see really substantive reform because, you know, of the disagreements between both sides. You know, what tends to happen in discussions around changing immigration laws, which don't tend to actually change very often, but, you know, it's this balance between Republicans wanting to push for more enforcement, more border security, and then Democrats wanting to push for an opening up of visas and avenues toward legal status, whether that's for people like Dreamers, whether it's for farm workers, people who have temporary protected status, but want something more permanent, you know, even people who've been here with years or decades with that status, but want to just, you know, feel a little more secure that they're not going to have deportation hanging over their heads at a sort of random increment of time. So it's that push and pull between the two. But, you know, what I'm hearing in my reporting, and I was surprised to hear it in a way, is that the sort of toxicity and, you know, lack of willingness to come together around immigration has never been worse. You know, it's what I hear over and over, that, you know, even sort of the low hanging fruit, if you will, you know, something like DACA, where you have, you know, a vast majority of Americans supporting a pathway to citizenship for, you know, Dreamers. You know, the Republicans are not wanting to get behind something like that just simply because, you know, Biden is president. You know, they'll sort of say, you know, we have a Biden border crisis and shut the conversation down there. At the same time, you have moderate Democrats who are very worried again about, you know, those same voters that Ron DeSantis and, you know, the like are trying to appeal to right now. You know, they don't, you know, these moderate Democrats don't want to alienate voters. And so they're really avoiding the conversation as well. And so, you know, I think there's a really difficult path forward, even if Democrats were to maintain control of both chambers of Congress. You know, it's very unlikely to me, unclear rather, that anything would happen. And then, you know, take away one or both, and create even more tension between Democrats and Republicans. And I think that the likelihood goes down even more.
Are you seeing any shifts in terms of the narrative and the discussion and the debate going on, given that we're in a really remarkable period, you know, time period where we're seeing labor shortages and wages are finally starting to climb up? It seems like it's a moment where maybe people's feelings about, you know, immigration would change. But, you know, I don't know. Are you seeing any of that?
I think that, you know, academics and business owners and journalists are starting to talk about the link between immigration reform and our economy. And I think that politicians are behind. But I think, you know, it's a logical link. It's a discussion that needs to be had. And so I think that they're going to be forced to catch up. You know, I do think it's possible that in the latter half of President Biden's, you know, first term here, that you could see, you know, a shift toward trying to lead on immigration, and that would probably harness some of this discourse and some of this discussion around the economy. Right now, everything has really gone quiet, and I think both sides are pretty scared of bringing up, you know, a controversial issue beyond, you know, in a substantive way, you know, and to talk about legislation. I've all but been told, you know, it's just simply not on the table pre-midterms. You know, in the next 2 years, it's possible that you could see President Biden try to bring immigration up again, go back to the plan or a version of it that he introduced soon after taking office, and to start bringing the economy into the conversation. And again, you know, you have Republicans out there who for a very long time have thought about immigration policy from a business perspective. As I mentioned earlier, you don't hear very much from them right now. They're not, you know, leading the party, but they could also reemerge, you know, depending on what happens economically in the next couple of years.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Lewis in Jamaica on the line. Hi, Lewis.
Hi. Hi, how you doing, Nancy?
Good.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you.
I just wanted to make the comment that this is a it plays over and over. Republicans always, in election time, bring up immigration. That's their cudgel to hit Democrats on. Whenever they have elections, they bring up, like in 2018, they brought back the caravan. There was a horde of people coming, and they're going to come in. Mind you, it was Trump in power, that he had power on the border and everything, and this was happening under his watch. And every time they have backed up from a compromise. If we remember in the 90s, Clinton signed an immigration bill. It made border stronger. The penalties for felonies made it stronger to try to get to a compromise. They were almost at a compromise. They backed out, because they want to use it every time on election. With Bush, the same thing. They had Immigration Reform Act. And who backed out? The right wing of the party, of the Republican Party. Every time it's the same thing. So they bring it up to distract from abortion issues, from people that from stuff that people don't agree with, from tax cut from the rich. Every time they bring it up, to get back to the same thing. And I don't agree with your guest. She's saying, the Democrats had a way to reach to do immigration reform. I mean, the problem is the filibuster. You never had that. So every time you got close, there's no way to get there. If what they're offering is let's close the border like they did with Trump, which is what they did in the Trump administration, because people don't think of what they did. They closed the border so people that had asylum claims couldn't go to the border. So what they did, they tried to get into the states and then ask for asylum in the United States, because it's a right, it's an international right. So, if you don't allow that, then that's what's going to happen. And then it's like Bannon said, they tried to destroy the administrative state. They tried to get gum up the works, the gears so you have you stop immigration completely.
Lewis, let me ask you a question, and then I'll let Caitlin address some of what you've said. But are you happy with what the Democratic Party has done? I hear your criticism of the Republicans, but I couldn't quite understand where you stand with the Democrats, which of course are who represents this area.
Okay, the problem is that Democrats are in a tough spot. They have the Fox News feeding fake news to more than half of the population on an everyday basis. So how you get consensus when you telling lies every day? For example, I mean, Bannon said let's stop the administrative state. So the only way that you have to solve immigration is to get more judges. Is if it's an asylum claim, then you get more judges and get to a conclusion. What they did was stop all that and try to stop all immigration. They made illegal immigration almost half of our world. They stopped refugees. And by the end, they said they wanted to stop all immigration. Stephen Miller said that.
Okay, let's get Caitlin in here, and thanks for your call, Lewis. And we're running out of time, so let me get a response for you, Caitlin.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call, Lewis. I completely agree with you that it's very clear the Republican Party has identified immigration as an effective tool for getting voters to get enthusiastic and to come out and vote, mostly from a place of fear prior to midterm and general elections. And we've seen a pattern of that for years now. I think that's right. And I think Democrats have not as effectively figured out a way to talk about immigration in a way that's going to that is moving voters. And you see that, in polling that shows it's an issue that Republicans care about more. And I also take your point about, the negotiations over reform that come up and then, they go away, they come up and they go away. And I think it's right that you say there's been some negotiating in bad faith there because of a desire to hold on to this message that has been so effective for Republicans. I will say in my reporting that I have not found, the Democrats in Congress clamoring for immigration reform, if only the filibuster didn't exist. And I agree as well that is a meaningful hindrance, even with Democrats controlling the House and the Senate. But, the filibuster aside, the enthusiasm for change on the side of Democrats, other than those who tend to focus on immigration, who tend to feel most passionately about it, and introduce bills over and over again, it's really not there. The moderate Democrats have, in many cases gone quiet on this issue. And so I think it's, both things are true, that you've had some disingenuous negotiation over the years, but also just a lack of sort of commitment to the issue that I think allows it to go away again and again.
Okay, I think that's a good spot to leave it there. Caitlin Dickerson is staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks so much for speaking with us, and congratulations on your terrific reporting on the issue.
Thank you for having me.